Welcome to The Art of Construction, the podcast dedicated to helping you grow your business. Together, we'll explore the world of construction with some of the best minds of the industry. Your host, Devin Tilley, a micro-influencer and sometimes disruptor, will take you on a journey that will lead your business to the next level.
What's up, Art of Construction Tribe? Tasmanian Devin here, and I am going to be going on a journey learning with you all as I have our guest co-host, Matt McMullen, coming back in where he's had some great conversations with the senior leadership of Blackhorn Ventures. We're going to get to know them and tell their story that are leaders in the art of construction. Huh, Matt?
Oh, this is an incredible firm. Folks are really, really enjoy this podcast.
Awesome. So the main message that we want to convey to our audience or our Art of Construction tribe today is that there are good reasons why construction has been late digitizing versus other industries. Can't wait to hear what Ray has to say about that. Construction is now digitizing rapidly thanks to both emerging technologies and business models, and the industry's current status in terms of three stages of digitization that Ray is going to talk to us about. So how, Tribe, is this going to benefit you? Listeners will understand why digitization is now not just possible, but it's essential for survival in their business. And the COVID-19 pandemic has added additional tailwinds to and drivers of digitization. Matt, what do you say? I'm pumped. Let's go in and get to know Ray Levitt, who is the operating partner of Blackhorn Ventures, huh?
Yeah, and I think our listeners are going to love this one. If you liked Ian Keough with Hypar, and if you also like the podcast with Paul Waddell of Urban Sim and Penciler, you're going to love this podcast.
Awesome. Here we go. Lock and load. What's your favorite beverage?
I'd like a gin and tonic on a hot afternoon. And if it's a barbecue, I'll substitute a gluten-free beer or two or three, depending on
the there you go.
Of the barbecue.
And it's hot right now. Boy, both of those, the gin and tonics is that time of year for sure, huh? So what's your favorite place you've traveled, Ray?
You know, I was born and raised in South Africa. I thought Cape Town is the beauty spot of the world, but I've discovered many others. My wife and I love the North Oregon coast. We spend many of our vacations up in Cannon Beach, Oregon. And we recently had the pleasure to go to Croatia for a friend's wedding. And that's a really interesting part of the world too, and exceptionally beautiful.
Wow. Give us one story from Croatia.
From Croatia. Well, you know, there's a dark side to the history, as we all know, the terrible war that went on between the various ethnic and religious groups after Yugoslavia broke up. But aside from burned out houses and the fact that a lot of Serbs are afraid to come back into Bosnia and vice versa, people who used to live there and be happy and coexisting with each other. The other thing is that these gorgeous spots, they're World Heritage sites, the Plitvice National Park with the crystal blue water and the coastal areas and the islands off the coast. It's stunning.
Outstanding. So what's your favorite hobby or interest outside of the construction silos we're passionately breaking down, what we call the art of construction?
I like the art of bluegrass, and I've made a lot of money at this because people pay me to stop playing.
Outstanding. Cool. Well, we got to know a little bit about Ray. What is Blackhorn Ventures, and how do you come and be involved in this venture?
So I have been an accidental university professor for a major part of my career. I made the mistake of staying in school too long in the 1970s, and no construction company would hire anybody with a PhD at that point. So I reluctantly became a professor, although it turned out to be a fun gig for quite a long time. During that time, I got involved in several startups. I took leave from Stanford to join a group of my students who developed software, and then I was a non-executive chairman of two other startups. And I really enjoyed the experience of working with innovative technologies and trying to bring new ideas into the market. So as part of all of this, I ended up teaching a course at Stanford called Entrepreneurship in Civil and Environmental Engineering. And for that course, we needed judges who were real VCs to come in and listen to business plan pitches at the end. And one of the judges who came in was a guy named Trevor Zimmerman, who it turns out was one of the original founders of Blackhorn Ventures in Denver. Trevor and I met, I had at that point decided I'd had enough of being an accidental professor and I wanted to take retirement and do something different. So I phased out over the next 2 years from Stanford and joined Blackhorn right as they were forming the initial seed fund. And I've been with them since. I subsequently fully retired from Stanford and spend most of my time with Blackhorn now. So Blackhorn is a series of funds. It's a seed venture fund that makes early stage, very early stage sometimes, investments in companies. We've actually decided to invest in a company and they didn't even have a bank account or a corporate registration yet. So I mean, that early. And then as these early seed stage companies began to mature and needed bigger chunks of capital, and we had confidence that they were doing well, we formed a growth fund we call our Industrial Impact Fund. And that fund now makes larger A and B round investments in several million dollars in some of these companies. And then subsequently, we have launched an even later stage fund, which is just getting going to make investments in the range of tens of millions at the, you know, at the right before public offering or acquisition stage, the mezzanine stage. So three funds. We invest in construction, and that's broadly defined the whole built environment stages from design through construction through property management, facility management. And then we invest in transportation and logistics as the second area, and those really are merging in many ways through logistics hubs and so on. And then the third area we invest in is energy, specifically renewable energy and grid management. So again, I got involved because I wanted to move from being a professor and a sort of small angel investor with the proceeds of my early startups to putting bigger table stakes in the game and playing with them, you know, with later stages of companies.
Exciting. We're excited to unpack that. So what's your position with Blackhorn and what do you do with them?
So Blackhorn has three managing partners who are responsible for raising the limited partner investments in the fund and for overall management of the fund. I lead investments in the construction space based on my civil engineering degree, my years of working both at the trades and in the engineering side of construction. And then the years of teaching where I have graduates all over the country in very senior management positions by now. And so it's easy for me to source opinions about different deals from executives and companies. And so typically one of the managing partners will be with me in any deal involving a construction-related company, but I will typically be the one leading the sourcing of the deals, the due diligence of the deals, the investment memo preparation, and then subsequently helping the companies by serving on their boards or just informally as an advisor. And we've made about 15 investments so far in the three funds in the construction space and about another 15 in the other two spaces. So we're predominantly at this point a construction tech investor.
So when you were putting Blackhorn Ventures together, Ray, what did you identify as your mission?
You know, we wanted to do well by doing good, let me put it that way. And so we wanted to make investments that were not concessionary and would return, hopefully, very excellent returns both to our limited partners and to the members of the fund. But we also wanted to do things that would, for example, reduce greenhouse gases, reduce material wastage, and contribute in different ways to the sustainability of the planet we all share. And we actually have a very serious impact gate that all of our investments have to pass before we will actually make an investment. And so I feel like that was one of the things, by the way, that really attracted me to this fund. When I decided to retire from Stanford, I was approached by several venture groups that focus on the industry. I particularly like Blackhorn's approach of, again, doing good by, you know, doing well by doing good. And the particular focus we have is to take advantage of the fact that this industry is late digitizing, but that many of the elements required for successful digitization are now in place. And, you know, we could talk more about that later if you like. But it just seemed like the right time to be investing in this space.
You touch a little bit on it when you were talking about construction and built environment. If you could talk a little bit about how that became one of the focus areas for Blackhorn's funds. You know, biomed, biotech, those things seem to be hot right now, even, you know, sustainable organic foods. But can you talk a little bit about construction and built environment?
Yes, I will. And there are two kinds of, roughly speaking, two kinds of venture funds that exist out there. There are those that are sector agnostic that will invest in interesting deals, say that are SaaS subscription model deals in any industry, or they'll invest in artificial intelligence deals in any industry. They're organized more around a type of technology or a type of business model. And then there are funds that are sector specific. So there are biotech funds, there are energy funds, there are several that invest only in construction. We felt that we wanted to invest in three industries that were late digitizing, because again, the emerging information technology, the smart mobile devices, the fact that there's now broadband everywhere through cell networks and much better, even Wi-Fi and other communication technologies to connect those smart mobile devices to the internet, low-cost sensors that are wireless and don't need to be installed in a very expensive way, and on and on. And then finally, the business model of SaaS-based subscriptions is, we believe, a perfect fit for all these three industries. And we wanted to pick industries where we had expertise and even operating experience, so we'd be able to intelligently source deals and invest in deals in these sectors. So I'm the operating partner for the built environment sector. Mark Locke leads our energy investments. Bill Ritter, the previous governor of Colorado, lead our energy investments together with Mark. And then we have transportation expertise. Logan used to work for Toyota Research. So again, we focus on these three industries. And what we want to do is leverage this emerging ICT, which gives us basically a free platform, these smart mobile devices, the broadband everywhere, the low-cost sensors. And then we're looking for a company with a defensible technology that leverages those things, that doesn't need to create them. They can build on top of them. And that have business models that can drive these radical resource efficiencies that create sustainable outcomes. So use less materials, use less energy, get rid of really mind-numbing, boring, repetitive tasks of data entry and things like this.
You know, one thing I wanted to jump back to, Ray, when you were talking a little bit about construction, you kind of look for serendipity in threads. And we co-sponsor a series that's bi-monthly on offsite construction. And as it turned out, we discovered by chatting in our pre-podcast discussion about a company that you had invested in called Manufacton. And Jason Barber, who's the vice president of that company, was on the last Tuesday of the month, June 30th. Could you chat just a little bit about them?
So offsite manufacturing is partly being driven now by severe labor shortages of skilled labor, although right now the industry is slowed down, so the labor shortages are not quite so acute. But they will be again, and they have been. And it's not just in the U.S. You can see it in the U.K. You can see it in many developed countries where people choose white-collar jobs over being out in the sun and the dirt and the noise and the danger and so on. And so what we have seen is this trend to offsite manufacturing, where you can have repetitive operations with workers that don't need all the skills of a four-year apprenticeship program and the kind of wages that construction skilled trade union people earn. You know, in the Bay Area, it's over $100 an hour. And so the offsite manufacturing is both leveraging the fact that lower skilled workers with lower wages can do a lot of the work, but it's also taking advantage of the fact that you're out of the weather, out of the elements, you can have better tolerances, you can actually build higher quality components. And a company like Manufacton acts, first of all, as a way to manage those factories using the best lean management principles that come from Toyota Lean Management System and other, you know, Japanese companies that then infiltrated back to the U.S. And they also manage the supply chain both inward and outward. So they manage the supply of materials coming into the offsite manufacturing shop, and they also manage the relationships with the job site. There's no point shipping a module to the job site if there's no place to put it and they're not ready to install it. And so they connect to the schedules at the job site to pull the modules when they're ready, and they pull the materials they need downstream. So it's both a manufacturing management and a supply chain management solution specifically tailored for modular construction.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned Toyota. When I was on Art of Construction, before I joined with Devin as co-host. Sometimes my show 83 was eliminate the muda from your process for project success. And that was one of the things that I found interesting in the offsite construction modular series, is he talked a lot about that, just in time manufacturing.
Yes.
Because as everybody knows in the construction process, time is money. And so let me move to the next question. Speaking of money in particular, you know, Ray, what are you looking for in your investments beyond financial return to support your core mission and values of doing well by doing good?
One of the opportunities that we became aware of early on was an opportunity to substitute much better environmentally friendly materials for Portland cement. As I'm sure many of your listeners know, Portland cement is made by burning fossil fuels to drive carbon dioxide out of limestone. So it's a double whammy of CO2. And estimates around the world are that this is responsible for anywhere from 7 to as much as 9 or even 10% of all greenhouse gas emissions, the manufacturing of cement. And then it often gets transported long distances from kilns to where it's needed. And so anything that could have the same properties for binding rock and sand and water, you know, into a tough, durable material like cement would be a big advantage. And we ran across this little company that came out of the Catholic University of Washington, D.C. called Ultra High Materials that had developed a whole family of cement substitutes that have properties that are equal to, or in many cases superior to, Portland cement, especially for precasting, because they can get very early set times so you can reuse the forms more often. They are better for saltwater intrusion. They're better for fire resistance. They can get tremendously high strengths all the way up to 20,000 plus PSI. And, you know, I wanted to take on the challenge of trying to help introduce this kind of material. And so that's the kind of thing we like to do. That's one example. You know, if that company is successful, it really, as Steve Jobs would say, it puts a dent in the universe in terms of reducing greenhouse gases. It actually makes a difference. And yeah, not every company will have that kind of environmental impact, but many of them reduce transportation costs, reduce wastage. And if you reduce material use, all materials typically involve some transportation and some embedded CO2. And one of the things about offsite manufacturing also is you can, you know, precisely cut materials and reduce waste dramatically. And so, again, we look for these kind of advantages in order to screen the investments we make and to prioritize the investments we make.
And I think it's crucial construction, on every single project, you have a foundation of some level. So yeah, that would be a huge impact just on the use of concrete.
Yeah. Even in a wood frame building, you've got foundations and you've got, you know, patios, and you've got, sometimes on precast buildings, you have non-load-bearing external walls, things that wouldn't even have to necessarily be subject to rigid structural codes. You know, it is a real challenge to get a new material brought into the industry. It has to be approved by ACI code committees that then translate into local and regional codes. And so it's also difficult to get engineers to specify an untested material because they're liable. But I believe with the contacts we have, and, you know, we're working with major cement companies worldwide because they feel threatened by the fact that they've got this horrible greenhouse gas material they're producing. And if they can produce something better, they will either disrupt themselves or be disrupted. So I'm hopeful that that one will succeed.
And great example. So, Ray, how do you see digitization playing out in construction and some of the effects that it's having on our industry?
Well, as I mentioned before, digitization is now not only possible, and as you said, Devin, it's really required, I think, for companies to stay competitive. The reason this industry didn't digitize earlier is obvious to anyone who works in the industry. You couldn't carry a laptop around a job site. If you're a foreman or a superintendent or a craft worker, you can't carry a laptop around, but you sure as heck can carry the equivalent of an old IBM PC from the 1980s in your pocket. And it's actually more powerful than those computers, and it's a heck of a lot more intuitive than the punch cards I used when I was in college. And so the fact that there are these smart mobile devices, broadband everywhere, low-cost sensors of all kinds, including cameras, audio sensors, cement maturity sensors, all kinds of things. And that there are SaaS subscription models that allow construction firms to scale up and down in their IT expenditure, because the problem with this industry, again, as anyone in the industry knows, is it's very, very cyclical. And we've just seen the latest example of how cyclical it can be when everything shuts down. And so if the overall economy expands by 5% or shrinks by 5 or 10%, construction volume in a region can go up by 40, 50, 60%, often 10x the changes in the national GDP. And so this is a reason why the business models needed to change, not only the technology. And so the first stage of digitization is often what my old professor used to call paving the cow path. You look where the cow used to go and you pave it. So you take an old paper-based process and you digitize it. So that's pretty easy to do these days with the technology available and this infrastructure of smart mobile devices and operating systems and cell networks and so on. But you get small, relatively marginal improvements by doing that. The second stage is getting the data from these various workflows that you've digitized together so you can start to see more unified data, and you don't have to enter data twice. So you enter it in one place and you decide which one is the ground source of truth. If the data is showing up in two places, you enter it once and it's available in the other one. And that happened pretty quickly with all of these SaaS-based applications having application programming interfaces, APIs that other software could extract data from or put data into. And then the third stage that I'm seeing happen now with companies like Brick, which is part of our portfolio, BRIQ, is that you take this data lake that you create by pooling the data from all the applications as well as the old legacy project management and ERP systems, and you create a data lake or a data pool for a company, including historical and current data, and you can start extracting all kinds of high-level insights about how you should target your bidding and marketing strategy, which subcontractors are the ones that have proven to be most reliable over time, which architects and engineers create bad blueprints and drawings that lead to lots of changes and so on. And so I see those three stages playing out. Most of what we see around there are these point solutions that are still stage one. And then as people begin to stitch them together, you see stage two. And then the stage three is applying various kinds of machine learning to all of this data. And it's really quite exciting to see the kind of insights and improvements you can get at that stage. And we're really moving into that stage right now. And companies that haven't begun to digitize yet will really have to scramble to catch up.
Yeah, when you were talking to stage one there, right with the cow path, you know, I was thinking about the 4th of July parades I used to watch in Kansas growing up. And the guys who followed the horses and the steers were kind of in that stage one. You know, just cleaning up the mess.
Yeah.
And next question for you. You know, in recent decades, and you touched on this a little bit, but what have been the chief roadblocks to achieving more forward-thinking construction industry paradigm versus just repeating what occurred before? And how are you helping to create that new paradigm at Blackhorn?
Well, we're trying. As I say, for materials, the liability concerns of engineers and the conservative nature of building code officials, all of which are justified because, you know, a major building collapses, it's a catastrophe. That's a handicap for new materials or new structural systems or things like this. For software, the challenge for venture capitalists and the companies that they invest in are that this is a project-based industry. And in many companies, project managers are given a lot of leeway as to which tools they use. They don't have things forced down on them by, you know, by some headquarters IT department. Some of the big companies are a little bit more forceful about requiring certain software to be used. Some clients require it. But again, what we typically see with these companies is they'll sell to one or two project managers who are willing to experiment, you know, the early adopter types. Those people will tell their friends if they like something, and then you'll have half a dozen projects in a region using a software tool. And then the software company will pitch it to the regional manager if it's a Turner or a DPR or a big company with lots of regions. And they'll do a regional enterprise license or sub-enterprise license. And once three or four regions adopt it, you get a corporate enterprise license. That often takes 2 years to get to that point. And so it makes these SaaS subscription companies grow much more slowly. And, you know, venture capital funds have a fixed term. They've got to be in and out within 10 years. And if you invest in the third or fourth year, you only have 6 or 7 years to get in and out. And so if these things don't scale quickly enough, they don't make sense for investment. And for startups, it's difficult to sustain the investment and sustain the momentum if you can't grow them more quickly. And so companies that can sell their software directly to the C-suite and get it applied company-wide are the ones that are successful, but we haven't seen very many of those. We have a few in our portfolio, thankfully.
Really good explanation of the challenges that you hit the nail on the head with a lot of that stuff of how we break down those silos and get the right buy-in. So Ray, what are some of the benefits that will improved, more sustainable and efficient construction industry have on the society as a whole?
You know, the Business Roundtable, which is a group of the CEOs of the 200 largest companies, got together around the late 70s, 78, 79, somewhere in there, and put together something called the Construction Industry Cost Effectiveness Project, because they understood that higher capital costs for their factories and the other facilities they needed translated into higher costs for their products and made them non-competitive worldwide. So lower capital costs for companies make their products more cost competitive, because capital costs can be a substantial part of their overall costs for a chemical plant or an oil refinery or something like this. For residents, it means housing is more affordable. And for governments, it means they can build more infrastructure. So improving the efficiency of the industry benefits every public and private part of society. And of course, getting rid of harmful greenhouse gases benefits the whole planet and less wastage of materials and so on. One other benefit is you can really improve the work in construction, and you can make it more attractive to the millennial generation, for whom the phone is an extension of their hand. If construction is not just filling out paper forms all day long, but it's actually using intelligent software and sensors and some robots, although this is a tough industry to deploy robots in, but it makes the industry more attractive to workers and will help to offset the labor shortages. A foreman who uses Rumbix to input time card data will never go back to filling out paper time cards again.
I think that's well said, Ray. The construction industry functions best when we all work as partners and as a team. So I'm really pleased to hear you say that, because it really is it's sort of a micro look into your mission of your company of doing well by doing good. Can you talk a little bit about the role building materials advancements play in the construction industry? And I know we'd kind of teed up the case study of the cement company, the cement replacement company. Are there any other companies that you want to chat about in terms of building material investments?
There are a number of companies looking at alternative materials. Again, you always deal with this, will engineers and architects specify it? Will building code officials approve it? But we're seeing specialized materials being developed for 3D printing. And we're not talking about 3D printing at millimeter scale. We're talking about 3D printing at meter scale with, concrete pumps that are robotic concrete pumps that lay out lattice work structures and things like this. So there's a lot of experimentation going on, but it's a heavy lift to get these things imported into the industry. Your listeners may know that When gypsum drywall was brought in as a substitute for concrete block partition walls, it took 15 years to get adopted across the industry, even though it was a much faster, much more flexible, you could mount it and dismount it much more easily than chipping out a concrete block wall to change the interior partitions in a building. And so recognizing it's a challenge, it's not always amenable to venture investment because of the timescales involved. But there are efforts being funded by patient investors like materials companies, Standard Industries, Cemex, and others that I think will eventually bring a whole new group of materials into the industry, but it will take time.
Hey, Ray, earlier you had highlighted on modular construction or offsite construction. Anything else that you would shed a light on as far as advancements in the construction industry along those lines that we've been talking a lot about with the Art of Construction Tribe?
Yes, I think so, because I've got rather a strong viewpoint on this. I didn't live through it, but I did study what happened when Mitt Romney's father, George Romney, who came out of American Motors and was brought in to run HUD, said, we're going to build houses like automobiles. And so George Romney tried to persuade some big companies with some success to create modular housing subsidiaries, Boeing, Honeywell, a number of big companies and some small startups started to build modular facilities. And then a few years later, we had stagflation under Jimmy Carter, where we had both very high interest rates. I remember signing a mortgage for my house at 13% interest rates. And we also had essentially zero GDP growth. So you had flat GDP growth with high interest rates, and housing came to a grinding halt, and every one of those companies went bankrupt. And so in a cyclical industry like this, investing a lot of capital in a modular facility and doing it all yourself is a very risky business. Katerra is struggling right now with a downturn. And to me, that's the antithesis of the model that I would suggest for this industry. The model I suggest for modular builders is to do what a small German car company did out of Aachen University. They designed a modular design for a postal truck for Deutsche Post. They outsourced every single component to small Mittelstand factories all over that part of Germany. They even outsourced the assembly to a Bombardier train factory that was underutilized. And they sold 50,000 postal trucks to Deutsche Post out of a small startup in competition with Volvo and a number of other, and Daimler and a bunch of big companies. So that's the approach that I like for construction. And there are several small companies that are doing kind of one-offs in the U.S. There's Project Frog that does school buildings and medical office buildings. Bone Structure is a Montreal company with a U.S. subsidiary that does high-end single-family homes. We invested in a company called Modulus, which is spelt like the word modulus, but O-U-S at the end, a U.K. company, which is taking this Aachen, Germany Industry 4.0 approach. They design a modular type of architecture for single-family homes and small multifamily homes. They outsource all of the manufacturing to multiple factories around the UK in each region. They outsource the erection of the buildings to local construction companies that are trained to do this installation. And they manage that supply chain. And to me, that's the way to do modular construction, because if the industry contracts, you just have your modular designers and supply chain managers, and everybody else has to deal with the downturn.
And you've got my mind spinning, Ray, because Art of Construction has a couple modular projects going on right now, and the delivery method is a little bit more dated. So I think I look forward to maybe an offline discussion with you further about that.
You know, if you can have a low enough cost factory, like what Ryan Holmes did in the late 70s, early 80s, Ryan Holmes was a Pittsburgh company that had its own factory that used to cost about $250,000 for the factory, so that they could amortize it in a very short time. And they went stuck with a huge capital cost and a lot of debt. And they had lots of clever ideas in their business model. If any of your listeners are interested, I'll be happy to share a case study. But that was one way you could do it, where you owned the whole supply chain yourself. But you know, the way Katerra has done it with big investments in modular factories and buying construction companies and so on, to me is a very risky way to do it.
Yeah, it seems like an old school model, kind of like a Getty or Rockefeller aggregation model.
You know, Henry Ford, who had his own iron mines.
So let me ask you, what does the future have in store for Blackthorn Ventures and your partners? Where do you see the venture capital group going?
You know, like every other private equity investor, including VC investors at this time, the companies we support have been impacted in various ways by this COVID-19 pandemic. And so what we have focused on is we continue to make seed investments, because we think a lot of really wonderful businesses get born during recessions. And so we're continuing to make carefully thought through seed investments out of our seed fund. Out of our growth fund, what we're doing is keeping our powder dry to keep the good companies we've already invested in that space going, and being very, very cautious about new investments, which I guess is a challenge to any company that we're not already in that's looking for an A and B round investments. And when I talk to my colleagues in other venture funds, most of them have adopted a similar strategy. It has slightly impacted our ability to raise limited partner investments for the new fund that we're creating and to close out our industrial impact fund. But we've also brought in some significant new limited partners even during COVID, because these people are seeing essentially zero returns in fixed investments like bonds or other kinds of fixed investments. and the stock market's not doing so well. It's basically up and down and a little down from where it was 6 months ago. And so they almost have to, pension funds and other groups that need a 6-8% return have to take more risk. And so we're still able to raise funds. And again, I think the outlook is this will gradually get better, and companies that survive this will be awfully strong going forward because a lot of the weaker competition will have been eliminated.
Well, what a great insight to an awesome company that the Art of Construction is honored to be partnered with. We ask the same questions when we get influencers into the studio Art of Construction, these same questions to close it out. So, Ray, what is your crystal ball for connecting technology to handshakes for the future of construction?
You know, we all have our processes and we do our due diligence and we do our financial models and so on. But, you know, to me, what we're really looking for is an exciting and talented and not too ideological group of entrepreneurs attacking a meaningful, large-scale problem with defensible technology and taking advantage of all of this marvelous IT infrastructure that's around. So connecting the technology to handshakes is about finding early adopters to do pilots and hopefully paid pilots, because I think free pilots is death by pilots for a startup. People just dabble, basically, if you don't get a commitment to go beyond that. And so the crystal ball, you know, in terms of new areas where we'll see opportunity, the market's pretty saturated with digital twin kind of companies. Robotics is a challenge in this industry because people walk around construction sites and there's debris around construction sites. Robots have to be very flexible and very smart to avoid problems. But in offsite manufacturing, robotics is the place we'll see growth. So we typically don't invest in hardware-oriented companies like robot manufacturers, but we invest in the software to make those robots work more effectively in our industry. So that's an area we look at. We've got a couple investments in that space. We'll probably make others. And again, we're looking for the stage three digitization opportunities where people are taking advantage of the pooled data from all of these different applications to get these high-level insights that really drive marketing and sales and that drive operational efficiency.
Hey, Ray, I have a clarifying question for you. You talked about defensible technologies. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that there's a significant amount of intellectual property that would be difficult for other people to copy. Now, a patent doesn't protect you from a big firm copying what you're doing. What it does is it allows you to keep doing what you're doing without them stopping you. You know, Microsoft faced down the federal government. They faced down Apple when Apple tried to stop them copying its folders and trash cans and things for Windows. And so it's not about patents. The defensible technology is about, these days, you know, with the machine learning applications, it's often about having more data and better data than your competitors because you can train smarter algorithms. And so a land and expand, get a lot of data, begin to develop meaningful insights from that data. So if your data is, for example, understanding what's in specifications and producing a quick output like what Pipe does, PYPE, so that you can give people a two-page bullet list of their requirements out of 2,000 pages of specs. The more specs you look at, the better your algorithms get. So if you are first in that field and you grow quickly enough, it's very hard for anybody else to catch you. So that makes it defensible based on having more data to train better algorithms. Having a capability to manage complicated marketplaces. We've seen some successful two-sided marketplaces. Building Connected developed a really good two-sided marketplace for connecting subcontractors to GCs for bidding. Autodesk bought them for a huge multiple of their revenue, you know, because they were so good at doing that. Dustin Devan did a beautiful job of that. And so the defensible technologies come in different ways, but in part sometimes it's really what we think of as hard science technology that is patented, the way a drug company would patent a drug. But it's also about business models that are difficult to emulate and about having more data than your competitors these days.
And you highlighted on so many different touch points that you know, we called talk about the data drop chasm when you're passing the baton, whether it's products or infrastructure and data. And that's where the Art of Construction tribe, we're honored to be leading and taking and breaking down those silos and putting that data into a source that can really come together, which is really powerful when you really talk about the 100,000 foot view of the art of construction. So you can really have the artists and the constructors all really coming together to manufacture like Manufacton that you represented with the data drop chasm. Cool stuff. So what is that one thing you would leave this podcast that we're closing in our 200th episode and the 375,000 listens we just hit? What is that one thing of your career from Stanford and Blackhorn Ventures and all that thing, all the different cool things you're working on for contractors and affiliates to think about to go out and crush it and grow their business?
You know, some of it's general. Hire people that are smarter than you in certain areas. Don't be afraid to give them their head and let them go. But I think to grow your business, you have to digitize intelligently. Now, if you don't, you're going to be left behind. Once GSA required BIM for all of its buildings, every little architect studio in the country was calling up Stanford SciFi Lab and saying, what is BIM? How do we do it? And from that point on, we just saw digitization start to move really fast in this industry. And people have talked about this industry having zero productivity growth in 50 years and so on. And I'm pretty sure when the Bureau of Labor Statistics gets the results for the last 2 or 3 years, this curve is bending up. I just see so many gains in efficiency from offsite manufacturing, from better use of digital tools to speed up decision-making and to coordinate more effectively, reducing rework and so on. This industry's productivity will improve. And if your company is not one of the ones doing it, you're going to be left behind.
Awesome. Ray, thank you so much for coming and telling us your story and Blackhorn Ventures. We're honored to have the Art of Construction tribe be affiliated with you guys.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to join this call, and I hope that this is of some interest to your listeners.
Awesome. Thank you. Matt, thank you so much for coming in and putting this all together. What a great resource for the Art of Construction tribe as we're connecting these construction technologies to handshakes with a fund and a place that's focused on doing good things in the construction, fitting our core values that we're all about here, leading the Art of Construction, huh?
You know, it was a great podcast. There are a couple of things I took away from. One, I give Ray an A+. As professor, it was a great podcast. Second thing, you know, he talked a little bit about, you know, hiring and working with people who are smarter than you. I think it's a little bit tougher for Ray than it is for you and I. But you could talk to Ray for hours. Man is so knowledgeable, understands the history behind where we've been, and also is able to see the future and take action on where we want to go in the future. So
yeah, he gave some great resources, and we'll make sure we make the custom show notes. So go check those out and get involved if you want to be a leader like this podcast is for you contractors and affiliates to grow their business. You want to know about Blackhorn Ventures. So go check it out and hit us up on the message board if you have any questions. Thanks, Matt, for another great episode. And Ray and Blackhorn Ventures and the team, great stuff. We're honored to have you as the Art Construction Tribe. Crush it out there, everyone.